Just a note before we start. Our show talks about touchy subjects that may be difficult for some of our listeners. Take care of yourself. If you feel you need to seek help, see the links at the end of our show notes for resources.
Welcome to Touchy Subjects, the podcast that aims to make those awkward conversations around domestic and sexual violence just a little less awkward. I'm Sean.
I'm Allie.
And I'm Amanda.
And today we're going to be discussing sexual assault in the Black community. And we have a special guest with us today. So Lisa, would you like to introduce yourself to our audience?
Sure. My name is Dr. Lisa Smith, and I am a psychology and criminal justice professor. I've been teaching over 20 years, and I live in Florida. And I have also worked in juvenile justice and with at-risk family and with military families. I'm a hypnotherapist, and I take that job very seriously simply because we have a lot of people walking around with trauma, and oftentimes talk therapy needs an addition because a lot of people aren't aware of their triggers, their subconscious triggers. So it's really important that I use it. It's my tool bag. It's part of my tool bag. I also run the Right to Consent, which is a sex crime reporting, probably one of the first reporting website in which a person who has been sexually assaulted, when they're afraid to report, because that's the issue, a lot of people will not report. They know the questions that are going to be asked. They can type them in. They can get an opportunity to be in a safe space to answer those questions. So by the time they do get to law enforcement, they have a list of all their responses, and they can send that to they can email that to a friend. So that friend keeps them on track, somebody who's saved, somebody who has allyship, who is not afraid to tell them, listen, we need to go and report this right away. I also work with at-risk youth, and I'm an author. I have written two books, but the book I'm here to talk about is Chad Keeps a Secret, in which we look at African-American boys, because many people feel that they've been left out of the conversation, especially with Me Too, since it focuses primarily on women. And African-American boys and their masculinity is always in question, because some people think that this may be part of sexual identification and orientation, and it's absolutely not. It's about victimization. So that's me in a nutshell.
Awesome. Well, we are, we're super excited to have Lisa talking with us today. We do our meet and greet with all of our guests, and we just didn't want to hang up the call when we did our meet and greet with Lisa. And we thought, man, we could do an episode right here. So we're really thrilled to have you. And honestly, Lisa, I think one of the things that we're most excited about in talking with you is the fact that we know that our work affects people from all different backgrounds, lives, you know, race, religion, income level, gender identity, sexuality. We know that domestic and sexual violence don't discriminate. But because there are so many identities out there, we want to be able to explore how these issues affect those different identities, right? Not just the mainstream identities. And so, when you sent your book, Chad Keeps a Secret.
Yes.
We loved it. It was great. I mean, it is important to be talking about why different communities need different resources, right?
Right.
So,
especially those that are cheap resources, because the conversations are just, it doesn't matter what culture you're in, the conversations, especially with children, are not being discussed. And right. Whatever boundaries someone sets for their child. And when they introduce the topic of sex and boundaries and privacy and their own space and respect of that, oftentimes we don't get to the point that you can be victimized without consent. And that's the reason why I want kids to be superheroes, to think that there is absolutely someone I can tell, even if my mom is not listening or my mom is not here, or I don't know who to talk to. My friend may listen and help me.
Yeah. And often when we talk about like sexual assault or like reporting domestic or sexual violence, it's usually those people are talking to their friends first. It's like they don't report that information to law enforcement. They don't report that information to like some like higher up. It's to a friend because they trust them the most. And if your friends are having bad responses or they don't have the correct response in that moment, we know that's going to decrease the likelihood then of them even reporting it to somebody else or even potentially seeking help.
If they don't feel validated from their friend, then why would they even think that they would be validated from someone in law enforcement or a counselor?
Especially keeping in mind that a lot of communities, you know, we're talking specifically today about the Black community, there is tension between communities and law enforcement. Right. And so if your own friend in your same community, in your same circle, doesn't even believe, trust, help you, why would a person of authority who historically represents oppression, why would they believe you? Why should you go to them? So that's really what we want to discuss today. So Lisa, can you tell us about some of the ways that this is true, that in different communities, sexual assault, domestic violence look different?
Absolutely. So first of all, with the Black community, sexual assault is historical. We have to link the thread back to slavery because women and men were chattel. They were property. So they could be bred, they could be used. You know, the idea of the Jezebel and the hyper-sexed Black woman. And even now when we look at young children, they are always hypersexualized, you know, even in their clothing, and the males are hypermasculine. So that all we'll have to link that back through slavery, because like I said, the breeding and not owning your body, not having control, your own agency, your socio-political agency. And as we move through different centuries and we find ourselves here in the 21st century, we see that this is still playing out in real time. So the conflict between the Black community and law enforcement, first, most of what we know, the stats are real. That's the reason why I love statistics. I teach statistics, I teach research, but the stats don't lie. The number doesn't lie. 1 in 3 to 4 children, right? 1 in 5, 1 in 6 males, right? So the problem is this, that when we talk about the African American community, it's underreported because there's no trust. And that trust happens to be, okay, if an officer is called to a home, will they help me or will they harm me? Well, in the Black community, we see that there's more harm. Even if you call for just mental health, you could end up dead. If you call for intimate partner violence, you can be taken to jail. If you call for theft, they may assume that somebody in your family is a suspect. So there's no trust. Let's just be honest. There's absolutely no trust when you call the cops, if they even show up. You know, in many communities, they don't show up. And then when you do report, there's all of the questions around, were you drinking? What were you wearing? Where were you going? Why were you out so late at night? And we're only talking about young adults. If we start talking about youth, then we're talking about child sexual assault. We're talking about child sexual abuse. And these kids generally the person who's taking care of them is most likely the person who's abusing them. So if they do see anyone from law enforcement or anybody from victims advocacy, it's Child Protective Services. And usually if they come in, they're going to break up the family. Well, I know that's not the child's intent. They want this abuse to stop, but they don't want their siblings to be taken away. So oftentimes, the resources we have are more punitive, more consequential, more detrimental to the child. And when they don't have agency, there's always the thought, okay, should I believe this kid? Because oftentimes white counterparts are believed and people of color are not. There has to be, and then it also, like when we talk about intersectionality, when you brought up Allie, intersectionality is really important because class plays a huge role. Race plays a huge role. Ethnic makeup, culture plays a huge role in the reasons why we don't turn to cops for help.
And like you mentioned, if you look at this from like the historical perspective, because you can't take history out of it, because if you choose to ignore that part, you're ignoring a huge part of the problem.
Absolutely.
Is when you have communities, specifically Black communities, that have been set up historically to been pushed into lower socioeconomic status areas, or those redline districts, you're actively putting them then in situations where they are at a greater risk for sexual violence. And then, like you said, mentioning the stereotypes that we often have around Black women being hypersexualized, you're just layering on all of these things then to a specific community that are creating an environment where they are going to be harmed at a greater rate or at a greater likelihood for violence against them. And you've also then created, because we overly police Black communities, a situation where the people who are supposed to be there protecting them aren't. Or they're being viewed as people who are just there to kind of like try to keep them in line instead of being there to actually be for public safety. So we've created environments where we are setting up Black community for greater harm and really aren't giving them any resources to either help or even allow for them to want to seek help.
And you bring up a good point about resources, right? The resources that are available are usually indictments of a cultural perception of stereotypes, because I know people who have sought counselors who re-victimize them. I know people who have been, especially when we start looking at the K through 12, there is an epidemic of blame the victim, blame the child. And we're seeing that even defense lawyers are using the case of victim blaming, because children are being sexually assaulted. They're going to their principals, they're alerting them, and then they are told they must have consented. They engaged in some type of sexual impropriety and they get expelled. Girls are getting expelled for telling their school administrators that they were sexually assaulted. And that sexual assault could have been physical, or they could have left class with the guy and decided they weren't going to do that. No means no, even if you are in the bathroom with him. But oftentimes they won't even report to Title IX. So if you don't report to Title IX, then you don't have that investigation, and that investigation is not reported. And so there are lots of cases where, because I've worked in the industry for so long, and I'm a program director, and they're coming to me and they're saying, listen, I've contacted the cops. I've contacted the school. They've done nothing. So I don't expect you to do anything, but I'm just letting you know this happened. Well, it always stops with me. I'm a mandatory reporter in every forum, and I will make sure there's an investigation. There are people who are alerted about it and that something is done, because I always follow up, I do. And sometimes I know that I am the only one that person is going to tell. And I don't always wanna just talk about girls, because like I said before, young African males are coming to me when I tell them about this book and they're saying, I'm glad there's a book for my son. because we are left out of the Me Too movement completely. There is no conversation about Black males and Me Too. And when I thought, I was like, absolutely right. When I heard Me Too, I was ecstatic about it. But even the trajectory of how we learned of Me Too pushed out the Black woman, right? So we see that Tarana Burke had this idea, had this hashtag, and it doesn't go viral until Alyssa Milana discusses it. And so this is where we see this disproportionate, just the thought that we're validated. I love what you said, Amanda, we're validated. And we have ideas that should be supported and promoted, right? So that's one of the beefs I've been hearing with Me Too. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And when we look at a lot of like the stereotypes and stuff that we have, or stereotypes that are placed on the Black community, because you mentioned kids. So the hypersexualization of Black women is often put on Black girls, but you don't have that same stereotype being placed on white girls. So when a young Black girl reports sexual assault, that hypersexualization stereotype is placed on them. So they're not taken as seriously potentially as a white girl maybe.
Right.
But then there's also that stereotype that we have of the Black community for Black men, where if you were asked in a general sense what a perpetrator of sexual assault looks like, you might have that very strong Black man be that vision that you have because of the stereotype of the Black rapist that we've created.
It's what we call the brute. There are two identifications, the Jezebel for the hypersexed woman, and the brute male was this big Black buck who comes in and rapes white women. Like I said, that's what Emmett Till was about. That's why Emmett Till died, right? And there are so many people who look at Black men not just as a threat, but as rapists. But the horrible thing is, because there's this code of silence in the Black community, most of the rapist, the abuser, that's someone you know. And it's most likely someone of value in your household or someone of value in the community. And we can't just put another Black man behind bars. I mean, this is the same thing we see with Bill Cosby, R. Kelly, Michael Jackson. We can't have these thorough conversations because we're indicting a Black man. But my question, as I say all the time, were you there? How do you know it didn't happen? And were you there? And if your answer is no, then the only option is to listen to what is being stated, right? Because details are really difficult to string together when you're lying, unless of course you're someone who has that disorder, right? But what we know is that because we don't want to indict a celebrity, so what are you telling me? You send them off to continue to harass and abuse other women? That's what we're saying as a Black community, as a collective. I remember the public outcry that this could not be Bill Cosby. I'm promising you he's in jail now because it was him, right? And this could not be R. Kelly. And should I listen to his music and should I not? And that just incenses me because people are being harmed at great risk that you don't wish to report. People are still being harmed, regardless of what you're telling me. R. Kelly, from the different indictments, he harmed others because we did not do anything. And inaction, like I said, there's denial, there's inaction, and then there's information suppression, which is a new theory called DIS theory that I've devised. Denial, inaction, information suppression. That's what we do. And not as just the Black community overall, because if this was a white male like Matthew Goetz, right, or a Jeffrey Epstein or a Harvey Weinstein or a Nassar, we say, oh, we need to support him. We need to make sure he's protected. We protect his job. And Nazar went on to do this for 20 years to these gymnasts, right? And so our inaction and denial and information suppression harmed more because he has like 200 plus victims.
Yep. Yep. And if somebody had just listened, you know, but there was time and time again where it wasn't the case. And you know what, I want to go back a little bit for our listeners, because this is something that we've talked about, you know, in our meet and greet, and something that Sean and Amanda and I find really important to talk about is this code of silence that you mentioned. What are some of the, can you explain that kind of code of silence that the Black community might have in response to allegations like this? And what has contributed to that feeling of needing to protect in ways that we don't see in other communities?
Absolutely. But the horrible thing is you do see it in other communities.
Well,
so,
you're right.
So for instance, but let's unpack it. Okay. For instance, Black men already have it hard, right? They can't get the valued jobs. They don't have the skills. They don't have the resources. So when we start looking at the intersectionality of race, gender, as well as economic, the socio-political world is against a Black man. Mm-hmm. And since we know that most of the perpetrators are males, Black males may run a household. So when you say that your father sexually assaulted you, or your uncle who comes to visit and takes care of you sexually assaults you, what is the consequence of that statement, right? It's not enough to just say that this harm is happening. It's how much money is that going to take out of my home because he's no longer here? And what does that mean? Because most of the time, if you indict a parent, there's going to be a sibling who's going to be angry with you, right? So, or they're not going to believe you, right? So there are a lot of people who chase the icon of what a parent is, and they chase the thought that this, I mean, we have so many absentee fathers in our community that to take another hardworking Black male out of the house is a problem, right? Is a serious problem. And then we have some of them are pillars of the community, right? So they serve to help others. You can have people who provide grants for foundations. You can have people who are leaders. You can have people who are community service oriented, because a lot of the Black community is grassroots. And so they're, on one hand, they are helping this large number of people. And then you have this scandal that they're also assaulting young girls. And when you have situations like that, then it's like, okay, if this person goes to jail, then we have that large number of people who are no longer being helped or aided by the job that he's done. Another thing is, you know, African Americans are really forgiving, because we've had to turn the other cheek on our own brutality. And since the rest of the world brutalizes us and mistreats us and devalues us, it's not unlikely that we see it in our own community, because we're not valued. Point. If we were to look at the totem pole, we're usually low on it. We're not valued in educational settings. We're not valued in institutional settings. We're not valued in healthcare. We're not valued. We're not valued in criminal justice. So the thought that this person should suck it up and move on and we should face resiliency is another thing that has to be addressed. Now, the other piece is that the religious aspect, right? There's a lot of empowerment in the Black family and the Black community through religion, but a lot of it does not provide enough information about the body, about sexuality, about sex. I mean, when we get into sexual orientation, that's a whole nother podcast, especially in the Black community and how they deal with that. But we have so many other issues to deal with that, you know, to take a person out of the home or to break up the family is already a problem, right? Because, you know, when you say that a child is sexually assaulted, there's an investigation. And if it's found to be true, then you have to find a safe space for these children to live. And that means sometimes splitting the family up. Yeah. And the consequence for many people is I don't want to break up my family. And two, I don't want the cops here at all.
Right.
I don't want them in my house.
While we were, you know, researching some of this stuff, I came across cultural betrayal trauma theory.
Yes.
Which is basically what we're talking about right here. And one of the things in it said that, you know, there's almost like a mantra that says, don't betray your race.
Absolutely. And the mantra for my household as I was growing up is don't tell family secrets. Sure. Right. That's great. And like I said, it's not just our mantra. You can find this in other cultures.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. But don't tell family secrets. That's nobody's business. What happens in this house stays in this house. Those are some of the comments that I heard being made as I grew up. And the fact that you would go outside your house and tell this secret to someone means that you are betraying the people in the house. And these are the people who basically ride or die for you. They're there for you. They're always helping you. And to do so without permission is a slap in the face, right? So that if it was up to many families, I'm sure they wouldn't tell. You know, it's embarrassing, it's humiliating, and you know, and then it indicts the mom. Okay, what were you doing while your child is being abused or assaulted? Where are you, right? And we know in the Black family we have two incomes. It's mandatory. It's not an option. Usually we have four incomes because there are siblings who are working. We might have extended family who are also working, contributing to that household. It is more community oriented that everybody, it takes a village to raise a child, right? And so that's basically what you see, the village mentality of, we need all the resources because we have so few. They're so limited. I'm fortunate enough to have grown up on Long Island in a house, that, you know, and I don't have to live in my aunt's house, you know, but that's not the case for many Black Americans, right? Yeah. They live in households where there's extended family.
Yeah. You know, and I want to point out, especially, you know, for our listeners here, that when we're talking about the economic impacts of Black individuals reporting abuse, we also have to take into account the disparity in what ends up happening to offenders in the system based on their race. There is a huge difference for how Black men are treated in the system for sexual offenses than how white men are treated in the system for sexual offenses. And so the stakes are higher. And for victims who are choosing to report, or let's not even say the word report, choosing to tell somebody about it, they know that, right? Those aren't secrets in any community. We all live in that world. And so to have that extra pressure, I think, especially for children, is something that we can't ignore.
And if we were to, just to compare, let's compare R. Kelly to Jeffrey Epstein. Jeffrey Epstein was put in jail. He was able to go out on work release. He went back to his office for 8 hours a day. And the state attorney signed off on that, right? And he was able to continue to see. I mean, he was a sex trafficker. Let's be honest. He was a sex trafficker. We see R. Kelly. R. Kelly also got a slap on the wrist. Let's talk about his marriage to Aaliyah. And then let's talk about the first allegations that we saw. And he was able to continue to make music. And now we see this huge scandal bringing in more women. But Jeffrey goes to Rikers, and we all know what happened with him. But R. Kelly, of course, they still needed evidence, even though they had all of these witnesses. So, as I say before, usually the, as you said, there's jail time. Who's going to get what? Are you going to get mandatory? And I know that statewide you might get mandatory sentencing, but the fact is that many of our leaders, especially prominent leaders, end up out on the street usually in 90 days, right? And now we're starting to see that even with the statute of limitations, how, I mean, if you're abused as a child, woo, you know, statute of limitations go on for your lifetime. But what about the effects of the 17-year-old or the 16 or the 12-year-old? Why are those statute of limitations different?
Yeah, even when we look at the cases too of like these very high profile men, is just the way that public perception kind of was a little different for, like, example, like Larry Nassar versus Bill Cosby. Is Larry Nassar sexually assaulted over 200 girls, and even when people came out against him early, when he was confronted with, he just, oh, it's just part of the treatment, it helps with the process, like, they don't know what they're talking about, and they believed him.
Right.
And then Bill Cosby having the allegations against him, yeah, there are people who still adamantly support that he didn't do what he did, but the fear that was there of not reporting, and then when it did happen, there were people who were like, okay, I can see it.
I have students who have told me just last year before we went into COVID, I don't believe it, miss. I don't want to hear you talking about it. Don't even say anything. I know he didn't do that. And I'm like, really? You were there?
Yeah. I've had a parent contact me saying that they were upset that it was disrespectful that I was using Bill Cosby as an example of someone who sexually assaulted people. It's like, if you don't want to have your name dragged through the mud, don't sexually assault people.
It's horrible. I mean, he didn't just sexually assault people. He used outlawed substances like Quaaludes. So that he admitted to on deposition. It's not my words. It is.
Right.
That he used Quaaludes, and they have been outlawed for some time. So my thought is, how was he able to use them present day? And more importantly, is he giving you a check? Why are you so strongly certain that he did not do this? Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, and we're talking a lot about, you know, perpetrators and offenders, but there's a huge difference in the way that Black victims are treated in public opinion versus white victims, right? Let's keep rolling with, say, Larry Nassar versus R. Kelly situations. Larry Nassar's victims were overwhelmingly Caucasian. They were celebrated by the end as survivors, which they should be, right? They survived that ordeal, and that took a great deal of strength for them to not only report, but to speak out so publicly against what happened to them. However, when you look at the women that R. Kelly victimized, right, there was not that same public opinion towards those women. And why? Because they were Black women. They Absolutely. Were Black women who were in the entertainment industry, who came from economically depressed areas in the United States. They didn't have that same public support that the victims of Larry Nassar did. And of course, I'm not trying to say that the Nassar survivors shouldn't have had that support. What I'm trying to say is that all victims need that public support.
And it's sad that we even have to make this distinction, right? Yeah. It's really sad that we have to make these distinctions. They are survivors and they should have the same resources. So when let's unpack what you just said. When we look at the victims of R. Kelly's betrayal, if you will, first, there's the public outcry, especially in my community. And I'm just going to tell you some things that I've heard from highly educated Black people that they knew that he liked younger girls. So they should have known what was going to happen. So that they dress a certain way. They're in the industry. That's what's to be expected. And it's almost like, well, you're going into the lion's den. Don't cry if you get bit. And there's not a lot of support for Black women, even in their own community, when they are victimized. There's not a lot of support for Black males in their own community, even when they're victimized. Right. And oftentimes the first hurdle that most sexual assault and rape victims face is, will I be believed? And so a lot of people, I believe, do not have enough information about how you help someone who's been sexually assaulted or raped. So because we keep our society ignorant of these are real allegations, and the support is not that you're lying, because that's a lot of people, you know, start screaming. I know people who have been hit and physically assaulted because they've made these statements, and or by their parents who yell at them and say, well, what were you doing in that house? Or what were you doing there? I was visiting my friend. I'm not expecting her brother to assault me. And when we start talking about juvenile sex offenders, as I was telling you earlier, we have a growing number. This is pervasive. Juvenile sex offenders, peers who sexually assault because this is their first experience, and the conversations on social media are pretty risque, if you will. They're highly sexualized comments. And you don't need to go far, because we objectify women in every video. And listen, I am a hip hop head. Let me start there. But at the same time, we are objectifying and accessorizing our women. They are always accessories. They are always a means to an end. And they are always objectified. Right. And here's my thing. You can go, you can wear what you want. You can be butt naked if you want. That's your choice. Should you be sexually assaulted because of it? No, absolutely not. So we as a community have this juxtaposition, right? We say we don't want harm to come, but then we sensationalize it in our music. And if you're a child, 9 years old, 8 years old, you think this is acceptable because, hey, I'm watching it on TV. If I'm watching it on TV or I'm listening to it in my headphones, it must be accepted. Somebody accepted it, right? Somebody said this was good. And, you know, like Cardi B says, I'm not a role model. I'm not supposed to be raising your kid. But there are still legions of kids who are watching all of these things play out. And
right.
I'm going to be honest. I'm not one to say that you should limit that. I'm going to tell you, if there was something that my mom did not want me to see as a child, she took me out of the room, right? There's always a channel switch to change what your child is being exposed to. But we do sexually objectify our own. And that message is clear in many, many cultures, but it's significant when we look at our culture, the Black culture. So I'm hoping I answered your question.
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's super insightful. Obviously, Sean has something to say. He's chomping at the bit.
Oh, just looking at like the things that we see in media and stuff too. It's like, we've talked about this before, Lisa. I'm also huge into hip hop, rap music and everything. It's, yeah, the messaging is there, But that messaging is prevalent in every genre of music, and it's been consistently prevalent as long as music has been around. But it's because, like, to use Cardi B's quote, like, I'm not a role model, I'm not here to raise your kids. Like, we shouldn't have to expect celebrities or people who we have given celebrity status to be the ones raising our kids. Parents need to be able to take that responsibility and saying, hey, I see this song is popular. Let's talk about that and have that discussion. The celebrities who make this content are offering excellent opportunities to have discussions with kids about what things are acceptable or not acceptable, or why our society is viewing some of these things as acceptable. It's just parents either aren't willing to have those conversations, or they don't have the skill set to be able to navigate those conversations effectively.
For sure.
So there's room for us to be able to work with parents then to be able to have those conversations.
And we should. It is imperative that parents gain knowledge about sexual assault. And the reason is because some of the earliest sexual assault cases, they're 4 years old, they're 5 years old. And they're, most of the time, they're dependent on the person who's assaulting them, right? And the mom and the dad aren't home because someone's taking care of that child. And they don't have the tools or the cognitive ideations to express what's happening to them. And for a child where that's repetitive and consistent, that becomes their part of their sexual identity. So it is important, because the true victims of sexual assault are so young that they can't fight. They have no agency. They can't fight for themselves. They can't even fend off the attacker. So we should, if we're going to reform all of these other socio-political areas, we need to start looking at sexual assault, because the taboo that we don't discuss sex with our kids is irrelevant at this point when you look at the numbers.
Yeah.
It's irrelevant.
It is. And we are all for body safety education and consent education with kids, because we know that that is the first step to true prevention. It's the first step to teaching kids not only that my body is mine, but your body is yours, right? Which is where we need to be later on, so that offenses don't happen, right? But do you see, this is something that we wanted to talk about. You know, we've talked a lot about the different ways that the Black community have barriers in reporting or responding to sexual assault. Are there differences, or are there perhaps the word would be nuances, for the Black community and in the ways that children are educated about things like their bodies and sexual assault in domestic violence, kind of those touchy subjects, if you will?
So my, I'm glad you asked this question. This is so vitally important, because, like I said, I'm constantly having arguments with parents about the need to talk to their children, not just about the anatomy, about violation, about boundaries. And the fact that I have fathers who tell me, I'm not going to talk to my daughter about sex. That is not appropriate. And when I bring up the fact that she could be victimized, the conversation stops there, because they're like, don't talk about my daughter, right? Don't bring my daughters into it. But here's the thing, you and I are not going to be around if she's sexually assaulted. So the fact that we can't even have a discussion and we're just talking to adults, right? They've personalized it so much so that that child is not going to be able to recognize the signs. They're not going to understand the risk associated with why you shouldn't go in the car. And this is not about strangers. Let's just get that out of the way. 93 to 95% of sexual assaults happen because of someone you are acquainted with or know. I can't state that enough. And in the Black community, it's 95%. Overall, it's 93%. But in the Black community, you know the person who's violating you. And in terms of girls, girls are the vulnerable population. So the fact that I can't have a conversation, and the thing is that just because they're older does not mean they're not going to be victimized. And the fact that they're victimized as a child means they'll be victimized. There's a likelihood, there's an increased likelihood that they'll be victimized as teens, and they'll be victimized as adults. 35% likely. So, you know, like I said, our own naivete is putting our kids at risk. And so the education of it is, you know, usually if someone's going to come and educate your child about sex, let's just ask, when did you get your sexual education class? As a teen, if you were sexually assaulted at 8, that class didn't help you because that class doesn't talk about it.
It's irrelevant.
They might talk about menstruation. They may talk about puberty, but my sexual education class did not talk about sexual assault. And the only time I had any exposure to any type of sexual assault was my friend was talking about it in my classroom, and I was 14. And she scared the bejesus out of me because she had been sexually victimized as a young child. She had no problem at 14 dating somebody who was 27, 28 years old. So for me, that's re-victimization, because now they have risk-taking behaviors. And those behaviors are maximized because they were victimized and because they have this distorted view of what is appropriate sexual interactions.
And if we use this, mentality of, no, I'm not going to talk to my children about this, that's not appropriate, then when something happens to your kids, how are they supposed to talk to you about it? Because you've already made it clear that it's an inappropriate conversation to have.
Right.
And a lot of times, you know, in my college classes, I'm usually the one who has these intimate conversations with them about what's appropriate. A lot of the students are, you know, they come to school virgins. So, and if there's no conversation and they haven't had any experience, then we're looking at the red zone. And the red zone is August to November, freshman on campus, likely to be assaulted, first sexual experience. And if your first sexual experience is an assault and you're a woman of color, that's more likely. So this is why, to me, I think it's imperative. It's just like any visit to the doctor, it's imperative that we start having these more in-depth conversations, not just with our youth and our younger children, but also with adults, because the workplace is scary, especially if you're a Black woman who loves the way you look. You know, many men take that as a invitation because you dress so sexy. And I have no qualms with what women wear, and I don't tell people what to wear. However, other people are looking at you as potential targets. And like I said, they don't do it. Bill Cosby showed us, if I can't get your consent, which evidently he didn't need it, I can drug you. And I don't need your consent, right? And so when people use substances like alcohol and weed and methamphetamines and all kinds of to disorient you, that's easily a way in which you can bypass consent for those who wish to hurt and harm.
Yeah. And to just take this discussion around victimization just a little bit, like another step, is often when we talk about victimization, we're talking about it from that perspective of a woman or a girl being victimized. So we're just completely leaving out men to begin with from the start of the discussion.
Right.
So when you have a stereotype around men that, and this is a stereotype of all men specifically, is that they're strong, they should be able to fight this off, should it ever possibly happen to them, or that guys are sexual beings so that it possibly couldn't be a sexual assault because they would want to have sex. But then when you add on those other intersectional layers to those things, because we've stereotyped Black men as the picture of a, like, yeah, the brute, the picture of the assaulter, it's even more difficult then for a black man or a black boy to talk about being sexually assaulted, because they understand the stereotypes that are around them already. So it's like, for example, when Terry Crews talked about his sexual assault, everyone's like, oh, there's no way he could have been assaulted. Look at him. He could have easily fought that off. So you're completely just denying the fact that this could even happen to somebody who looks like Terry Crews. So you're just isolating all of these male victims to never even want to talk about being assaulted.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you bring up Terry Crews, because a lot of people don't understand molestation is about groping, right? Sexual inappropriate touch, right? But still, it's non-consent. So when we try to put sexual assault in these boxes, we're always going to fail, because male, let's talk about the sexual assault of black males. They're almost always rites of passage, because you were able to have sex at a young age and maybe it was your babysitter. But the other thing that they don't talk about is the hypermasculinity in organized sports, mm-hmm. or fraternities, in which you are likely to be sexually assaulted by your frat brother, or you're likely to be sexually assaulted by a group. You know, people don't talk about digital penetration, but that's with your finger, right? And these are sometimes rites of passage into the club of a football or a basketball, right? And these are things where you are in, like, these things, these behaviors are considered sexual assault, sexual violence, if you're being held down, physically restrained, and someone is touching your body and you don't approve and you don't think it's funny. And it might be done in fun, but listen, you can, if that's reported, anybody who participated, even the bystanders or the ones who helped restrain you, are in equal amount of trouble, right?
And it's only fun if everyone's having fun.
Absolutely.
If there is somebody who is being forced into this or coerced into it, and maybe not even fighting it, but they know they don't get into the club unless this happens and there's that coercion with it, that doesn't make it fun. That makes it an assault.
Right. And then, you know, I always get the flack from my athletes who are like, see, now you're going too far and you said too much. You're doing too much, Smith, right? And it's just so astounding that they don't understand. Listen, this is the law. I didn't write the law. This is what it would be considered. And trust me, if that student or that person goes home and reports this happening and writes a report and gets law enforcement involved, you're going to be indicted, because somebody saw it, somebody witnessed it, right? And when we talk about young males, a lot of times they're victimized by same sex. And so that gives the homophobia that, because I was sexually assaulted by a same sex peer, I could potentially be gay, right? And so that there's that internal struggle. There's the depression associated with that. And there's the questioning of sexual orientation. I mean, it brings out so many issues that a lot of people aren't willing to discuss. And it annoys me, it incenses me that people don't understand. You're talking about a child, a person's sexual identity. The assault itself brings questions. Whether same sex or opposite sex, the assault itself brings questions about sexual identity. If you're young enough and this is your first sexual experience and there's an orgasm associated with that and it's repetitive, there's two ways this can go, because most of what I've researched, kids who sexually victimized were sexually victimized as in vulnerable ages. Okay, they only relive and replay out what they saw. Then they become adults. So now we have a multitude of people who, because they were victimized at younger ages, they victimize others. And then there's one who's like, I'm not going down that road and that's not for me. But what do we do about the multitude? Because we didn't do anything back here when they were victimized. We did not provide training. Most parents are skeptical about counseling and getting what they need. And so, and the trauma of it, the trauma itself is long lasting. You want to talk about lifespan? Long lasting. PTSD, long term. And that has to be addressed.
Yeah. So then looking at addressing some of the effects of being sexually assaulted, looking at the Black community, we've already mentioned how there is a distinct lack of resources available for a Black victim to be able to reach out for help. So in your opinion then, Lisa, what are some ways that we can start working towards creating better access and equitability around these resources for the Black community?
First, we need to raise awareness, right? Because every time I go to somebody's house, I always hear, not my child, that's not going to happen. But I have cases where people in my field have educated their children. And what happened when their child was sexually assaulted? They froze. They couldn't fight. They couldn't speak. They couldn't talk. That parent thought, I did everything I could. So the first thing is raise awareness. The other is to allow the child knowledge, access to the same information that the parents have in a way in which that child can understand. It should be age appropriate. Boundaries and respecting space is great. But when that child is in the house by themselves, what tools do they have, right, to fight back? Sometimes just saying, I'm not going to keep your secret ever, is enough to deter, because that secret keeping is an isolation, social isolation and threats is what keeps this child in this repetitive cycle of abuse, period. And so the words, we need to give the children the words when they come across someone who's touching them or trying to. The first is not just stop. My mother's going to know you touched me here. I'm going to tell my mother. And I don't care what you say, I will never keep the secret. And there are so many kids who tell me they threaten my mom, they threaten my grandmother, those kids think they're real. So we need to educate them that if you are threatened, you come and tell me immediately. And I am not going to blame and shame you because you couldn't get away, because it doesn't matter. There are some very violent, evil people that are going to have their way in this space at this time. But remember, our goal is to make sure that the child survives the assault and can come to you. And a lot of people are like, I don't leave my kid overnight with anyone. But even though you don't do that, a lot of times the socialization when they get to college is not there. So they don't know how to act in certain situations, and they take drinks so easily. And I'm not, like I said, I'm not indicting the parents. That is by far not what I'm doing. But when children are with other children, they become, and teens are with other teens, their peers, they are interested in the social influence of the situation, going along to get along. I have so many students tell me, I was at my girlfriend's house. Her and her boyfriend went into one room. Me and this new guy went into this other room, and this is how this assault happened, right? Once, I mean, they need to know, if you don't know this person, you should not be in that room with them. And maybe this is your cue to leave, right? Because when we talk about Blasey Ford, what happened with her? She was in a party thrown by teens, and she went to go to the bathroom, and these boys took advantage of her, right? So when is it appropriate, right? When do you know that you're at risk? When you're with strangers. But remember, Christine Blasey Ford knew these guys. She grew up with them. So she wouldn't have thought she was at threat. So like I say, a lot of times, if you're going to the bathroom, take your girlfriend, the reliable one who's not drunk, right? A lot of times in the school system, because like I said, I'm trying to move that needle. In the school system, the buddy system is essential. And your buddy can't leave your side. And sometimes that can be a guy and a girl. I always say three, because you need that overimposing guy who respects boundaries and is not going to get you drunk, right? But you also need that friend who's also looking out. And if that means you're just going to the party, I don't care. You know, we need more vigilance and sense. We can't expect the parents to have all the answers. We need to empower our children. That's why I say, you know, our kids can be superheroes. I've watched kids stop abusive assault on their mother, right? So I know that there is common ground. We need to prepare them for all of these things. We prepare that we put all kinds of things when it's a snowstorm and a hurricane. We prep them for all these other things. Why can't we prep them like they're going to war? I'm not asking them to become mixed martial artists, but what I am asking is that they know that somebody they know might hurt them, could harm them. And what do you do if it is somebody you love? Because it's a betrayal when it is somebody you love. You tell. The secret keeping has to stop. Yeah. Did that answer your question?
Yeah. And looking at it too, is absolutely the risk reduction techniques, like teaching them, they for sure have a place. But it's also looking at teaching that acceptance of other people's boundaries and not pushing those boundaries. Because if we are refusing to have conversations with our kids about how to accept other people's boundaries or to accept when they hear a no, if we're not teaching them those things at a young age for things that we might see as mundane, we're not giving them the skill set then to be able to accept those no's or to not push boundaries when they're older. So we have to, in addition to those risk reduction techniques, all the ones that you listed, Lisa, is also just educating like how to accept those boundaries that people set. Because as we've learned from the past year in a pandemic, even adults have a hard time of just respecting people's boundaries.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And as I said before, the sexual predator is not going to respect your boundary. Mm-hmm. But like I say, also, it is important that the children know how to combat, speak the words, speak the language of a sexual offender. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that we've given them those tools. Like most of the time, even in most books, they'll tell you, okay, this is my body. But they won't tell you what to say. Yeah. My book says, okay, if you are told that you have to keep a secret, what if you tell me the secret? Then I can tell somebody. So then now it's not just solely your responsibility. Now and they need to know, adults need to be included in this conversation. And that's if somebody gives you candy, because grooming happens over time. If they are given candy, it's funny. I just watched how candy, you know, people don't understand the power of candy. Especially for a kid who's told I can't have candy. Oh,
that's some sugar. That's some good sugar. Right?
And they don't understand the power of a gift.
Yeah.
You know, little girls like pocketbooks. That's not expensive to a predator. Not if that child becomes their victim over time. That's not expensive. Mm-hmm. So they're investing their time. They're investing their money. But they're investing, and what people don't understand is the routine that mom's not around and dad's not around. And these children aren't socialized to think I'm a threat.
Well, and talking about the gift giving and, you know, like the inexpensiveness of candy or little toys, things like that. If you're looking at a community who is in a more economical hardship status, then all through life, we're reinforcing that with, you know, well, this person spent that money on you. You need to appreciate what they gave you. Go give Uncle blah, blah, blah a hug because he bought you this toy. And so we keep reinforcing that, especially in those communities where those toys may be hard to come by, or, you know, we can't always afford to get the candy. So when somebody goes and does that nice thing for you, now you owe them something.
Absolutely. The obligatory control that a person has because they purchased something, they have access to you. And a lot of times that is an invasion of space. And that's why I don't make kids hug me. Even babies, you know, people think that you could just pick up a baby and just kiss them. You know, even babies have boundaries. And when they cry, they're saying, I don't know you. I don't want you in my face. And parents don't often respect that because it's their child. And as I said before, you know, we are the gatekeepers of our children. And the information that I think is most valuable is knowledge. Knowledge is always something that is intangible that we take for granted. But when children are aware and when they're with their little coffee klatch friends, I tell them, now I want you to go and teach your friends about this, because oftentimes they're the only little voice in the room. They're the only little voice in the room. And, you know, a lot of people think that children are too young to have these experiences. I've said this over and over again. If this was the 1900s, they'd be taking your jobs. They'd be working. Okay. At 13, they'd be married. So yes, previously they had responsibilities. It's only because we became more industrialized that they don't have these responsibilities. But if you tell them what's important and what's at stake, they believe you. And if they trust you, they will listen to you. But your children say the darndest things. Why aren't we educating them about something that can help them and not harm them? Because the last thing I want to hear is that something happened to a child I love. And I have a bunch of children that I know I don't want anything to happen to. But I always feel like if I'm the psychologist in the family, that's not going to happen. But I know that's, I'm still naive, that can and that will happen. And we need to take a different approach. And that means educate the kids, teach them the appropriate words, teach them that secrets aren't, unless the secret is about a celebration and a birthday party, there should be no reason why little kids are keeping secrets from their parents. But more importantly, they need to know, mommy, are you going to do something? Because I feel that we sometimes don't do enough, right? Mm-hmm. Just telling a parent who's not going to report it. Reporting should not be at a low when the children are the ones who are most vulnerable.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't envy parents in the slightest. I don't have children. I know Allie and Sean don't have children.
As far as I know, I don't.
Oh, God, Sean.
But, you know, you're running this fine line of, you know, don't turn your children into tattletales by having them come tell you every time somebody, you know, takes a toy in the toy box. But then, you know, you're expecting them to tell you something that's this big important thing. In their minds, they can't make that distinction. So when you've got like parents who are, you know, being so aloof about these little things that happen in these kids' lives, you know, you're basically just kind of teaching them that, you know, mom's going to decide what's important and what she's going to help me with and not, or, you know, that dad is. And, you know, we can be kind of working against ourselves in this situation just because of that concept.
And I'm sorry, you bring up a good point, because I know of a case where a 5-year-old brought a pornographic magazine to school to show his friends, right? And wanted his little female classmate to recreate what he's seeing. And so there's these two boys and this little girl in the bathroom. And of course, it brought outrage to the families as well as the school district. And the parents, of course, could be in trouble for that because there are laws about pornographic information, access that children have, and how the children use that information to potentially assault another child. Those are real allegations and those are real charges, right? However, that can absolutely create a whole host of issues associated with parenting, associated with consequences for certain actions, talking about sex. I mean, like I said, the stigma in the Black community is that sex is taboo, right? And I'm sure other cultures, sex is taboo. Mm-hmm. Wait till you're married. But a same-sex child who wants to kiss and hump and do all of these sexual explorative things, that may happen at 7. That may happen at 8. That may happen at 9. They're not going to tell you about that, right? They're not going to have that conversation with you. They're not going to have that conversation with you about their cousins who came to visit, who are opposite sex, who sneak into their room at night and may assault them. But they need to know that those scenarios exist. And they need to know that as much as I'm trying to keep you safe, this is a two-way street. You have to help me keep you safe. And in times where you have consented to let somebody kiss you, because little kids, you know, they do explore kissing. I don't want to say that that's not part of the sexual explorative behavior in all kids. I don't care what community you're in. But the violation, those conversations need to be addressed. And more importantly, when I start feeling uncomfortable, how do I say stop to my older cousin? How do I say I don't like what's happening to my uncle? How do I say stop? Don't touch me. I'm going to tell my mom, right? I would rather a child that screams wolf, I'm going to tell my mom that you're touching me. I'm going to tell my mom that you touched my butt, right? I would rather have that child who's not victimized than a child who's victimized and didn't say enough. Mm-hmm. So I bring on the tattletale. I love that.
Yeah. You know, it's so important. And every time we have these conversations, especially around how to parent with these issues, I always feel a little bit bad because by the end of the episode, I'm always like, oh, we've probably made parents out there feel super overwhelmed. But I want everybody that's listening to know that it can be simple. It doesn't have to be complicated. You don't have to have a degree in talking to your kids about their bodies. There are resources out there. That's what our job is. What people in our field are doing, that's what we're trying to get to you, is these resources, is this information. And books like Chad Keeps a Secret by Lisa, those are helpful, right? Those are the tools that you can lean on when this feels kind of hard and confusing. And like always, we will post some links to resources at the end of our show notes today. Mm-hmm. Our favorite website is themamabeareffect.org. Great information on how to talk to your kids about their bodies, how to talk to them about autonomy and respect for other people's bodies. And the most important thing is that they're age appropriate. So that is our favorite resource. And, of course, Lisa's book is fantastic. And, you know, arm yourself with a tiny little library of body safety books, right? Throw one in between, you know, your kids' two favorite books at bedtime. This doesn't have to be a birds and the bees tough conversation. It can be a bedtime story. It can be a good morning, let's spend some time together story. So don't let this big scary issue of sexual assault scare you away from educating yourself and educating your children. Mm-hmm.
So before we wrap up today, Lisa, do you have any socials that you would like to, you know, plug for yourself to our audience?
Absolutely. RightToConsent.com is my sex crime reporting website. But one other thing that I did want to mention is Chad Keeps a Secret also tells you how to identify the signs of a child that's been sexually assaulted and the way in which they socially isolate and social withdraw. So sometimes, you know, parents might not be able to identify the signs. And there's also a bunch of resources in the back. RAIN.org gives you lots of stats, gives you great information. And if you are someone who's in college or on campus, there's loads of media, social media. We have 1 in 6 if you're male, which is a great resource. And the resources are out there anytime you, and they come in all different stages and ages, which I believe is much different than when any of us on this podcast were going to school. So like I said, RightToConsent.com, but that's after the assault. My goal is to prevent the assault from happening, right? And there are hotlines in your state for a child that you know that might be abused, Child Protective Services. There is a real push on federal, local, state level to arm parents and children with the resources they need. And if you don't have someone that you can talk to, just contact me at drsmith@righttoconsent.com. That's right to the number consent.com.
Thank you, Lisa. And thank you all for listening today. I'll make sure that we post a link to Chad Keeps a Secret in our show notes. So if anybody is interested in buying the book, you'll be able to find that link there. Like I said, thanks for listening today. Please feel free to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok at TouchySubsPod to keep up to date when we have new episodes coming out or just information that we're spreading. Email us any questions, comments, or concerns to TouchySubjectsPodcast@gmail.com.
In the meantime, don't be afraid to challenge, ask, and discuss when it comes to touchy subjects.